Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the efforts underway by House Tea Party Republicans to scuttle the Mueller investigation by pressuring the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein into handing over Mueller's secret evidence or face impeachment, which would provide Trump with the excuse to fire Rosenstein. David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who is the co-founder of the investigative news service DC Report, whose latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, joins us. We will discuss his latest article at the New York Times, How to Initiate a Criminal Inquiry into Trump, and assess whether the call by former Republican Majority Leader of the Senate, Bill Frist, to the Congress to protect Mueller's investigation will be heeded, and what other avenues of investigation could be pursued in the event that Trump, in league with the Tea Party attack dogs of the House's so-called Freedom Caucus, are able to fire Rosenstein and hobble Mueller. Then we'll examine another aspect of Trump's vindictive, cruel, and racist attitudes towards Latino immigrants, and that is his stealth program underway to quietly discharge immigrant recruits who joined the U.S. Army with a promised path to citizenship. Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Reserve Affairs, and Logistics in the Reagan administration, joins us to discuss how Trump is using his power as Commander-in-Chief to further his own personal nativist and xenophobic agenda to undermine the structural and moral integrity of the armed forces who have led the way in promoting civil rights since President Truman's executive order in 1948, ending discrimination in the military. Then finally, with Trump departing soon for the UK, the NATO summit, then his meeting in Helsinki with Russia's President Putin, we will look into the possibility that Trump will find a way to undermine NATO at its core by threatening to withdraw American troops and funding as he castigates NATO members for freeloading. An expert on NATO and European affairs, Charles Kupchan, who spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as special assistant to President Obama for national security, joins us to discuss the contrast between Trump's praise for Putin and Moscow's delight at how well a meeting they hosted with Republican senators on July the 4th went, compared to disquiet among our closest allies that America's president is pretending Russia is not a threat so he can make the case that we don't need NATO. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He's the former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DC Report. And his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. And he has an article at the New York Times, How to Initiate a Criminal Inquiry into Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me on again.
Well, thanks, David. And just before we get into what alternative avenues there are, if Trump, in league with the Tea Party Republicans in the House, is able to set up Rosenstein to do the impossible and therefore impeach him, and that would perhaps provide Trump with the excuse to fire Rosenstein and hobble the inquiry. Do you think that that's in the cards? It seems to be the way we're heading, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think that there is no prospect of Trump being removed through impeachment for a very simple reason. It takes 67 votes in the Senate to convict. Impeachment is simply a charge, an indictment. But in a Senate trial, you have to have 67 senators. Well, right now, there are only 49 Democrats. The idea that you would see as many as 17 or 18 Republicans vote to remove Trump from office is ludicrous.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that, David. I wasn't suggesting that. I was saying that the tactic on the part of the Tea Party Republicans to pressure Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein into doing the impossible, which is to hand over the work product of the secret investigation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And therefore, then when he refuses, which he must do, then they impeach him. And then Trump says, see, how can you deal with a guy that's been impeached?
Sorry, I misunderstood your point.
Sure.
They certainly would like to shut down this investigation. And yes, I think they may try to create an incident here to do this, even though it's an abuse of power. It's really very disturbing here to see what's going on with the Republicans. This was the party of law and order for many, many years, and this was the party that was always suspicious of the Kremlin, and I think we now have to say this is the party that said it was suspicious of the Kremlin. They clearly want to shut down this investigation. Why would you want to do that if there's nothing wrong? If Trump is just as pure as the fresh-driven snow, what possible objection could he have to an inquiry which would clear him? And the answer is they all know that Donald Trump is the third-generation head of a crime family, so they want to do whatever they can to stop this investigation because through Trump they're getting what they want, which is a government of, by, and for the American oligarchs.
So do you think there's any chance of anybody listening to Senator Bill Frist's call for the Congress to protect Mueller? And what's your sense of why these Republican senators went to Moscow? And Lavrov, the foreign secretary, Russia's foreign secretary, said it was a fantastic meeting. It really went well. And we know that the meeting with NATO probably won't go well. So something's odd going on. So the Republican Party has bought
in. I absolutely agree with you, and there's something very odd going on with the Republicans and the Russians. And at this point, you know, we don't know. What we do know is a couple of key things. Donald Trump absolutely would like to get rid of NATO. He has been advancing the agenda of Vladimir Putin. The Republican senators who went there on our Independence Day, some of them have indicated they think that we should end the sanctions on Russia, even though it hasn't given up Crimea or the parts of the Ukraine that it occupies. Talk about caving in. Talk about the kinds of things that these Republicans have denounced Democrats for forever. This is just an astonishing development. And on, if you step back and look at this as a sort of cosmic observer, I think what you observe is that all around the world, democracy and self-governance and the liberties of the people are under assault, and we are seeing the rise of dictatorial regimes. Donald Trump is a dictator in waiting. He praises Erdogan, who's trying to turn Turkey into an Islamic dictatorial state. He praises Duterte in the Philippines, who brags about murdering people. He praises Xi, and the prospect that he'll be president for life is something Donald says he likes. I've actually gotten calls and emails from people who say that as soon as we get our constitutional convention, we're three state legislatures away from having a constitutional convention, they intend to make Donald emperor. These are people who do not love our Constitution and our country. They want an authoritarian dictator, and they want a government where if I don't like you, I can use the procedures of government or act privately to harm you. And hopefully the American people this November are going to wake up to this terrible mistake we've made, and they're going to give us a new Congress. But the indications at the moment are they're not. And let me just, if I could, Ian, point to the race in Fresno. The district that Devin Nunes, who has been carrying Trump's water on the Intelligence Committee, represents, half the people in that district are on Medicaid. Devin Nunes wants to basically get rid of Medicaid, and yet he's likely to get reelected. Why? Because the Democrat running against him is running the most incredibly incompetent campaign. If you just go to his website and look at it, the first question you ask yourself is, why would I vote for this guy? Why would I vote for him? And this is going on all over the country. The Democrats don't understand how to market. They don't have any big case that they're making, except they're against Trump, when they could be doing things like saying, we're going to take the costs of health care and the burden of health care off the backs of business, especially small business with universal health care. We're going to make a tax system in which super rich people and corporations can't make a profit off it. And listeners who get the American Prospect, you can get it online, read my article about how Apple makes a $113 billion profit off the Trump tax law. It's an astonishing story, and it's one where journalists didn't read the tax law. They wrote what Apple and the White House told them, which, while technically true, was 100% misleading.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He's a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DC Report. And his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. And he has an article in the New York Times, How to Initiate a Criminal Inquiry into Trump. And of course, on Monday, Donald Trump will announce his pick for the Supreme Court and further extend a conservative domination of that court and of the federal judiciary, since he's appointed so many judges. I, by the way, David, have to make an apology to our listeners who've written in and pointed out that I keep getting my mathematics wrong. Never my strong suit, that I kept thinking, well, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, then he'll have a 7-2 split, but it'll actually be a 6-3 split whoever he appoints on or nominates on Monday will be replacing Kennedy in the 5-4 split that we currently have. So apologies to our listeners for my bad mathematics. When you talk about the Devin Nunes race, that's the DCCC, David. I mean, the prosecutor that you're talking about down there, his two issues are, if we have the death penalty, how come we don't use it? And, we need to be stronger on the Second Amendment. The guy that they could have run by the—
he might think those issues would help, but if you're faced with two candidates who are proposing not greatly different policies, why wouldn't you stick with the guy you've got?
Right.
The fact is, in a district where it's close to 50% Latino voters, I'm not sure the exact number, maybe one of the listeners can email in what it is.
It is. It's over 50%. In fact, there was a Latino community organizer who was running against the DCCC guy that's useless, but he didn't get any backing. So
You've also got half the people on Medicaid. The Democrats have just not learned how to market. You know, one thing, the 30 years I've covered Donald, I respect that he is great at, is Donald knows how to take something and reduce it down to an advertising slogan. And he is brilliant at that. You know, his use of language and emotional connection to people. The Democrats talk in what my friend, the journalist Donnell Morton, calls clinical policy, as in blah, 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 blah. And, oh, hey, Ian, in case you didn't get that, blah, 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 and even more important, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't resonate with voters, and I don't understand this complete inability of the Democrats to grasp this. Here's something that should scare the dickens out of you, that I'm the only person I know of who reported in the country. The big four Republican committees, the Senate, House, governors, and the overall committee, raised $174 million more than the comparable Democratic organizations in the last year. That's over 50% per American. And the net worth of the Republican campaign organizations is more than four times the net worth of the Democrats.
Right. Well, the DCCC are brain dead.
They're rolling in money, and they're not, Democrats.
Well, the DNC is brain dead. All they do is solicit money without—
Well, they don't even do that well. If you go to their website, the Republicans ask for money right up front, and they make a pitch to you. At the Democratic website, which is terrible looking and bad colors, unless you think to scroll down the screen, you'll never know that they have any positions on anything, and then they're all written in what my friend Donnell Morton calls clinical policy. Right. So are we going to talk about how to get Trump under criminal investigation?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to do. Now, I'm sorry that we got a little sidetracked there, but what are the alternatives? You've written about them in your New York Times piece, How to Initiate a Criminal Inquiry into Trump. Walk us through those possibilities.
So here's where you as listeners can actually have an impact. And I hope you take a moment, get out a pen and a piece of paper, because I'm going to tell you how you can actually do something for our republic and what to do. The New York State Attorney General has civil authority, and she used that authority to sue Donald Trump, his three older children, and the Trump Foundation for civil fraud in the Trump Foundation, which used money to make campaign contributions, which are illegal, to buy portraits and football helmets and other things for Donald Trump, which is illegal, and do a whole host of other illegal things. Because she doesn't have criminal authority, she referred these matters to the Internal Revenue Service and to the Federal Election Commission for criminal investigation. Well, the chances that the federal government, through those agencies, will begin a criminal investigation of Donald Trump are zero and minus 1,000. But under New York state law, if Democrat Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, refers this case to her, the Attorney General of New York, Barbara Underwood, acquires criminal investigative authority. And Andrew Cuomo doesn't even have to do it personally. He could tell an aide, tell the State Department of Taxation to refer Trump's taxes and his children's taxes to Barbara Underwood for a criminal inquiry. They did this all the time. There wouldn't even be a record of Cuomo doing it, and he could say, if he does it in a smooth way, you know, the State Department of Taxation referred this, and, you know, they do what they think they should do. Now, Cuomo is not going to do this. Cuomo has taken money from Trump. He hasn't returned that money. He has, I've shown in the past, been very protective of New York City real estate interests, where I have shown that there's massive tax cheating going on that could be easily uncovered, even civilly. Not just criminally would be better, but civilly, and collect hundreds of millions of dollars each year as a result. So here's what people should do, and sorry, I hope you've written this down. Call Cuomo's office and tell them that you want a criminal investigation. Now, the office is going to ask you your zip code, and if you aren't from New York, they're going to say thank you and goodbye. But so give them a New York zip code, 14607, 10023, 10025. And his office is 518-474-8390. 518-474-8390. If you hit 1, you'll be go straight to a recording. If you hit 2, you may be on hold during business hours this coming week for several minutes, but you will get a live agent. And don't go into a harangue. Just say, you know, I want a criminal investigation of Trump's taxes. And the number again is 518-474-8390. This is not something that will work if people call once on Monday. You got to put it on your calendar and call your friends. And what would really cause Cuomo, I believe, to change policy is if we could get so many people to call that the Albany telephone exchange crashes. Because then it would be news that so many Americans are demanding a criminal investigation of Trump's taxes. It crashed the Albany, New York telephone system. So, you know, try and get everybody you know starting Monday to call 518-474-8390. Now, if you go to dcreport.org, dcreportsingular.org, right now in the top wheel of stories is one that says something like Johnston and the NY Times. And in it, we have an action box. We believe at DC Report, which is nonprofit, totally supported by donors like your station, and mostly volunteers, that we own our government and we should act like owners. And it's a point I make in my New York Times op-ed that ran July 5th. It's our government. We own it. We should act like owners. No man is above the law. And Donald Trump, there is robust evidence Donald Trump is a criminal tax cheat. He's been tried civilly twice for tax fraud and lost both cases. He's confessed to being a sales tax cheat. There are lots of indications, and I talk about it, particularly an audit the city of New York did of him, that he hides records and lies and denies. There's robust evidence for a criminal investigation of his tax returns. The other person who has authority to do this is Cyrus Vance Jr., the district attorney of Manhattan. And let me just add that Zephyr Teachout, who's running for Attorney General in New York, I don't think she's going to win, but she is running. She says that if she becomes Attorney General, she will seek a criminal referral on Trump's taxes. So far, Cynthia Nixon, the supposedly progressive candidate, has been unwilling to respond to my questions about, do you want a criminal investigation of Trump's taxes? She's run off and hid and not responded to this. But I think we need to pressure everybody we can think of. And where you have Democrats in office, Cyrus Vance, the district attorney of Manhattan, and and Governor Cuomo, who hopes to be president, you know, he has visions of being president, tell him you got to do your duty. All you're doing is authorizing a criminal investigation. If there's nothing there, so what? If there is, what a good thing would happen to have a state of New York indictment of Donald Trump for tax crimes.
Well, also, I think listeners should put pressure on the journalism, the New York Times and other newspapers in New York to find out why Cuomo is soft on Trump. In fact,
I have emailed almost every member of the press corps in Albany with links to my article in the New York Times, my articles in D.C. Report, and suggesting they ask Cuomo about this. Cuomo is a guy who's very tied into the real estate business. And in the past, you know, he once said when I challenged him about this corruption in real estate taxation, he said, I didn't know what I was talking about. And as you know, Ian, you can say a lot of things about me, but Right. Not that I don't know what I'm talking about.
Right. You've been called the de facto tax collector of the United States. I thank you for joining us, David K. Johnson. And I hope our listeners take your advice.
Ian, thank you very much. And again, it's 518-474-8390.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He's a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DCReport.org. And his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. And he has an article at the New York Times, How to Initiate a Criminal Inquiry into Trump. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the stealth program underway with Donald Trump quietly discharging immigrant recruits who joined the U.S. Army with a promised path to citizenship. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a professor at Georgetown University. He's a former senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he served as assistant secretary of defense from 1981 through 1985 in a position in which he administered about 70% of the defense budget. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Larry. And you were the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Reserve Affairs, and Logistics in the Reagan administration. So, you've been on top of this story, which I see as a kind of stealth effort on the part of President Trump to basically purge the U.S. military of the dreamers of these young immigrants who are promised a path to citizenship in joining the U.S. military, and they're all being quietly booted out. When did you first hear about this?
It's almost exactly a year ago, and you called me. I said, I remember, and I wrote it on July 11th of 2017 in the Military Times warning about this. And then it sort of had died down. I had hoped that maybe after some of the points myself and other people made that they, you know, decided not to do this. But now we find out they not only are going, they have been doing this, and it's just come to light because of NPR and AP.
The Associated Press article you refer to, it has been getting some attention. There was an op-ed also in the New York Times by Rob Cuthbert, a veteran, Trump's new targets, immigrants in the military. That op-ed makes the point that this is sort of undermining the moral authority of the military in a broader sense, because the military in this country is the only functioning meritocracy. And when President Truman desegregated the military in 1948, that was ending discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin. And this seems to be a reversal of that trend in the armed forces, to make the armed forces the kind of exemplar of the better angels of our nature, if you will.
Well, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, this particular program that took in people like the Dreamers was started in 2008 by President Bush. And, you know, it's called the Military Accessions Vital to National Interest. These are people who have skills that you can't get other places. Doctors, you know, for example, health professionals. And the great irony, and I agree, you know, morally it's horrible, but it also has a practical implication. Right now, the military is having trouble attracting enough qualified people because the economy is so good. 70% of people in this country are not eligible, you know, can't join because of various, you know, physical or, you know, moral considerations. So to be throwing these people out who have skills that you need, and, you know, right now, we have 70,000 immigrants in the armed services. Are you going to throw them all out, or is just this program? And what is it going to do to other immigrants who might be thinking of coming in? And the reasons are bogus. This idea, well, they might be a security risk. Does everybody in the military who has relatives? I remember when I was in the Navy, we had relatives behind the Iron Curtain. You know what I mean? So this whole idea that somehow if you're in the United States and you have relatives abroad or you came from abroad, you're a security risk. There's no evidence to support that.
Well, there's no evidence as far as we know. Donald Trump recently made a remark that Middle Easterners were sneaking across the southern border pretending to be Latinos and holding up Latino children as props, and that was his justification for tearing children away from the arms of their parents. And by the way, there's 3,000 kids. They don't even know where they are. And what Trump is doing is demanding DNA tests of everybody, parents and children, which is going to take a lot of time, a lot of expense, based upon Trump's own sort of nativist xenophobic notions about this, you know, MS-13 invading our country. It seems like that mindset is also being extended as commander-in-chief. He's pushing this purge of the military, of all these Dreamers and the 70,000 immigrants who've joined up the military as a path to citizenship.
Yeah, there's no doubt about the fact. And, you know, it's not the only thing. You know, it's no accident that when he came in with his anti-immigrant bias that the military started, quote-unquote, slowing down the process. And it's just like with transgender people. You know, he's saying, well, they're, you know, he makes this thing, well, they're no good. There's no evidence to support that. And I wish Mattis would either say, if you don't stop this, I quit, because that would really get people's attention, given the respect that people have for him. And he knows better. He's been a commander in the field. There are many, you know, people, immigrants that he's commanded in battle.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a professor at Georgetown University, and he's a former senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he served as assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration as assistant secretary of defense for manpower, reserve affairs, and logistics. And we're talking about this purge underway of the U.S. military, mostly Latinos. But, you know, in the AP story, they mentioned some Pakistanis who have joined the military to with a promised path to citizenship. Well, surely the Pakistanis are useful, aren't they, since we're involved in Afghanistan?
Very definitely. You'd want somebody who understands the culture of the area, and obviously the Pakistanis are right on the border, and we're working with them to try and, you know, get rid of, you know, the Taliban. I mean, if I'm in a battle zone, I want somebody who speaks the language and understands the culture of that area. You know, I mean, it would be like, say, you know, look at all the Japanese who served bravely with us in World War II, or people of Germanic and Italian, you know, backgrounds who joined our armed forces to fight. So, yeah, in fact, as I say, you know, in 2012, the Soldier of the Year was one of these people. In 2012, most outstanding soldier.
Right, that was Sergeant Saral Shrestha from Nepal, yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And so this idea, and, you know, it's not only morally, you know, terrible, but it's also going to hurt our national security, not only because we won't be able to get enough qualified people, but what message does it send to those people who are thinking of, you know, resorting to terrorism or something against us?
Well, since September 11th attack on the United States in 2001, and you mentioned that George W. Bush, President George W. Bush, created this program, nearly 110,000 members of the armed forces have gained citizenship by serving in the U.S. military. So 110,000 immigrants have become citizens since 2000 and since 9/11. So
right.
There you have it. I mean, that's a lot of that's a big chunk of the standing army, isn't it?
Well, no doubt about it. And as I say, that's why, I mean, aside from the moral considerations, the promises you've made to a lot of these folks who were, you know, going to reserve drills, waiting to get called up to go on active duty so they can get it. The practical thing, where would we be? How effective would our military be without these 110,000 people?
So we're going to be joined in a minute by the former head of European Affairs on the National Security Council under President Obama. But since you're in touch with the military, and you mentioned General Mattis, and there's a great deal of concern that Mattis may be the next to resign because he's finding himself marginalized and Trump is acting unilaterally, like, for example, canceling maneuvers between South Korea and the United States without informing him. We know that Mattis is slow-walking Trump's ridiculous, vainglorious idea of having a military parade, and there are reports that this is frustrating Trump. If you lose Mattis, then there's no adults left in the room. Then you've just got sycophants and war hawks, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I don't think Trump will fire Mattis, given the, you know, how he always talks about the military and how much he, you know, respects him. And given, you know, Mattis's standing, and as you say, in the country, I mean, even among, you know, people who are opposed to Trump, both in the Republican and the Democratic Party, don't want him to go. I just hope that he doesn't decide that, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, and for example, as I mentioned before, what does he think about the immigrants he's commanded in battle when, you know, this is happening? And you know, I mean, that I mean, at some point, he's got to be willing to, you know, tell the president either you do this or else.
But is he around to tell the president? Because what I fear, and a lot of analysts on NATO and in national security affairs in general, are concerned that what this peculiar affection that Trump has for Putin, and the fact that he's got this summit with him after he visits the UK and the NATO summit. I suppose the good news is that he didn't visit Putin before the NATO summit, but after it is bad enough because there'll be no note takers and we won't know what goes on in that meeting. But the assumption amongst a number of analysts is that what Trump's agenda really is to make the case that Putin's not a threat. He's a great guy. I get along well with him, just like I do with Kim Jong-un. We have nothing to fear from Russia. Therefore, why do we need NATO? Which is what he keeps saying in any case. Do you think that's the subtext?
Well, what I do worry about is he will do something like he did in Korea, cancel, you know, U.S.-NATO exercises, maybe take some troops, you know, out of Europe. I mean, that's, I think, what we really have to worry about. I mean, you know, the rhetoric is one thing, but the fact of the matter is if he does things that weaken our ability to deal with Russia, you know, that becomes, I think, the long-term impact of that would be disastrous.
But where does General Mattis come in that? In other words, surely somebody has to make the argument to Trump that NATO is a false multiplier, and nobody's saying that they shouldn't pay their fair share. Of course they should, and Trump is right to pressure them. But on the other hand, to undermine NATO, there's got to be, somebody's got to, you know, and assuming that, I'm assuming it's General Mattis, has to say, listen, this is the reality of what NATO means, and Article 5, after all, was invoked for the first time when the NATO allies joined the United States in Afghanistan.
Right. I think he has to do that. And the one good thing, I think Bolton doesn't want to undermine NATO either. You know, he wants to be tough against the Russians and keep troops there. So I don't think, you know, he would, you know, encourage Trump to do anything like that. He wants to be tough on Russia. So I think, you know, he would not, you know, go along with something like that. But you got to worry, Trump gets in the room for 45 minutes, supposedly, you know, at the beginning there with no people. Well, in fact, the translator isn't going to be one of the Russians, not going to be one of ours. You know, that is in the room. That's what you really got to worry about.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, going back to the fact that the Trump administration is quietly discharging immigrant recruits from the U.S. Army, what can be done? I mean, it's a terrible thing to have these dreamers and others join the military with the promises of path to citizenship and then suddenly be booted out of the military. Where do they go? I mean, are they immediately deported?
Well, a lot of them are. And I remember a year ago when I got into this, I talked to a lot of these folks. They were worried about, you know, the fact that, they go back into this uncertain status, you know, with the dreamers. You know, they keep changing and they're putting limits on it and all of that. You know, we were hoping that by this time we'd have the comprehensive immigration bill that would deal with that. But no, they go back into the same status. They, you know, at certain point, if nothing happens, then they got to go. And so, yeah, I mean, and that's just horrible to them. Not only they shouldn't have just because of, you know, being born here, I mean, being brought here as youngsters. But the other thing is they were willing to sacrifice and die for the country.
So is there anything that our listeners can do, do you think?
Well, I think the Congress can put an amendment on the, you know, the 2019 budget that says, you know, keep the military accessions vital to our national interest, the so-called MAVNI program, you know, in effect. I mean, I think they could do something like that in the, you know, in the bill, because, you know, they want the budget, and so if they put that amendment in it, I think that would stop it.
So just in closing, do you think that, I mean, the American people were appalled at the treatment of children being ripped from the arms and babies from being ripped from the arms of their parents at the southern border. I'm surprised that this story is not getting more attention, but assuming it does eventually, do you think that's going to have an effect?
Oh, I think so. And, you know, point out, as you have, you know, 110,000 immigrants have, you know, served the other immigrants we have in there, and it's, you know, a national security issue. I think we'll get people's attention in addition to the moral thing about somebody willing to fight and die, and now you're going to throw them out of the country.
Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks for having me, and take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a professor at Georgetown University. He's a former senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he served as assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. where he administered about 70% of the defense budget. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back speaking with an expert on NATO and European affairs about this peculiar contrast between Trump's praise for Putin and Moscow's delight at how well a meeting they hosted with Republican senators went on July the 4th compared to disquiet amongst our closest allies that America's president is pretending Russia is not a threat so he can make the case that we don't need NATO. Buffalo soldier, dread like Rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as special assistant to President Obama for national security. And he is the author of Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Charles. And do you share my concern, and it's been expressed by others, that the president in a rally in Montana the other day was talking about how he's going to get along great with Putin and Putin's not a problem and it'll all be fixed. And it's similar to what he said about Kim Jong-un, you know, that just personal meetings are what it takes, and if you get on well with somebody, suddenly, by extension, the countries get on well with each other. Obviously, there's an immense amount of naivety in that, but is there also a kind of hidden agenda here where if Trump is able to say that Russia is not a threat, or at least to pretend that Russia is not a threat, and say how great I got on with Putin and how we can just solve all these problems, wouldn't that also lead to Trump making a case that we don't need NATO?
Well, you know, Trump is not someone who has gone out of his way to build relationships with anybody, except perhaps his children. And if you look at his foreign contacts, he seemingly built a friendship with Macron. But that didn't go anywhere. Macron had invited him to Paris for Bastille Day. It looked like he had built a strong relationship with Abe, the president of Japan, prime minister of Japan, but that didn't do Abe much good when it came to North Korea. So there's really, in my mind, only one exception to this pattern of Trump essentially kind of ignoring his foreign counterparts, and that is Putin. From the very beginning, he has talked about him as someone he admires. During the campaign, he seemed to show a special favoritism for Putin. Now he's heading off to Europe. He's probably going to make a hash of the NATO summit, just as he did at the G7 summit in Canada, and then go off and have a buddy-buddy heart-to-heart talk with Putin. Why he feels this way toward the president of Russia, what perhaps the Russians have on him, we don't know and we may never know, but it clearly stands out among the president's relationships, most of which seem to be pretty distant and pretty cold.
But is it as bad as it is to even be speculating about the patriotism or the loyalty of the president of the United States? is and the extent to which he may be compromised by a hostile foreign power and with some kind of undisclosed relationship with Vladimir Putin. That's unprecedented and as bad as you can imagine, that the fact that we even have to think about this kind of Manchurian candidate scenario that's out there. But what I find even worse and more inexplicable is, why are the Republicans going along with this? Why did those Republican senators have that meeting on the 4th of July in Moscow, at which the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, said it was one of the best meetings he ever had, and it was just absolutely great. And you just said that the meetings in Trump's about to have with NATO are not going to be great based upon what happened at the G7. So there you have it. What's going on?
You know, I don't want to jump the gun. I don't want to talk about the Mueller investigation, because we just don't know what went on. We know that some people have been indicted that were close to Trump. We know that there were contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians. But exactly what kind of evidence will come forth of collusion or financial wrongdoing, we simply don't know. And you know, so I'm not going to kind of go down that road. But his desire to have a close relationship with Putin clearly suggests that something strange is going on. And as you suggested, he has really moved the needle when it comes to the Republican Party. If you look at Republican public opinion surveys, Americans that are Republicans all of a sudden have a positive view of Russia. And that started during the campaign. And now you have, as you mentioned, these Republican senators who are going off to Russia. And this is in stark contrast to a party that has historically been quite Russophobic and quite hard on Russia. And I find this to be one of the most disconcerting aspects of American politics right now, because, you know, you can say that President Trump was an accident, Hillary Clinton wasn't a great candidate, the Russians interfered, yada, 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 right? So we ended up with a president who's unfit for the job. But to have a Republican Party that is putting up with this president, that is essentially lying down and taking behavior that is illiberal, behavior that treats the free media as the enemy of the state, behavior that demeans truth and the practice of liberal democracy, you know, the fact that the Republicans are just staring at their feet throughout this is really very, very disconcerting, because in the end of the day, it suggests that the party has essentially been captured by its own self-political interest rather than looking out for the interests of the nation as a whole.
So just to finish up on the strange meeting of the eight Republican senators in Moscow on the 4th of July, with a group of senior Russian officials led by Foreign Secretary Lavrov. There was also the Duma member, very hawkish nowadays. I used to know him years ago, Vyacheslav Nikolov. And Slava Nikolov now has become quite a hawk. He said the meeting with the American lawmakers is one of the easiest ones of my life. Kislyak, the former Russian ambassador to Washington, said that they told the eight Republican congressmen things that they'd never heard before, that our guests heard rather clearly and distinctly, that Russia did not interfere in the U.S. elections. And, of course, that was echoed recently by Donald Trump in a tweet where he said Russia continues to say they had nothing to do with meddling in our elections. So, again, you can't dismiss this as naivety. I mean, President Putin lies about the Malaysian airliners, about the Green Men, about the invasion of Ukraine, about the use of chemical weapons in Syria, about Russian military killing civilians in Syria. I could go on. So why this sudden belief in the veracity of Russia's claim that they had nothing to do with meddling in our elections, when all of the American intelligence agencies say that they did?
Yeah. I think that Trump is right that the world would be a safer place if the United States had a good relationship with Russia. Russia's got lots of nuclear weapons. Russia is not a global power like the United States is. It's on the way down, not on the way up in terms of its economy and its demographics. But the problem is that for that better relationship to emerge, the Russians have to change their tune. And you gave the laundry list of bad behavior, but on Ukraine, on Syria, on the question of interfering in Western elections, on basic facts and dealing with the world as it is, not in some make-believe la-la land, the Russians just are not a serious partner right now. And why the Republicans as a whole or the president specifically aren't willing to face up to that is odd. I would point out, though, just as one piece of evidence on the other side of the ledger, that the Congress did pass legislation with Republican support that hems the president in on sanctions against Russia. You may recall that the president was dragging his feet on applying sanctions for Russian interference in the election. So Congress went ahead and said, one, you can't remove sanctions without our permission. Two, we want you to move ahead with sanctions. Trump then dragged his feet for months, but eventually did impose some sanctions. But now he seems to be circling back and returning to this odd policy of pretending to be Vladimir Putin's best friend.
But in doing so, he's also not pretending, but he's openly critical of Angela Merkel, who arguably is the linchpin. Germany is the linchpin of NATO. He's sent in a very hostile sort of Tea Party type right wing ambassador who's making to Germany, who's making overtures to the AfD, the neo-Nazi kind of right-wing party that's emerged out of nowhere. Trump's taking the opposite position that Merkel is taking on immigration, and she's very vulnerable on that. And on top of that, of course, he's saying that we won't have Germany's back, essentially, threatening to either pull American troops out or pull funding out from NATO. So you have to add that, surely. That's the part of the puzzle that's even more bizarre.
You know, over the last month or two, I've begun to arrive at the conclusion that Trump may be more ideological than we think. At first, many of us said, well, the adult in the room will prevail. That didn't happen. Then we said, you know, he's just a transactionalist and he's driving hard bargains on NATO or on trade because he thinks that we need a better deal. That's not unreasonable. But now he is making such a hash of our relationships with our key allies that I've come around to the view that he actually has a visceral antipathy to Europe, with the exception of European governments that have gone in a populist, nativist, nationalist direction. So what we might be seeing is that he likes Putin because Putin believes that the West means a white Christian West. He likes Poland because Poland now has a government that has become illiberal and has passed legislation saying, what, Poland? We didn't have anything to do with the Holocaust. Viktor Orban is going after George Soros, a kind of undercurrent of anti-Semitism, a pro-white Western Christian nativism. Trump is drawn to that. And I think he sees Merkel and Macron and most West Europeans as too liberal, too multicultural. And so I think part of the explanation for the fact that he's giving the back of his hand to the German leader, but seems to want to embrace the leaders of places like Poland, Russia, and now Italy, which has a populist government, I think we're seeing a more ideological side of the president than we did earlier. And it may have something to do with the fact that we're heading into the midterms. He thinks his best play is to double down and rally his base. And frankly, he may be right, because I don't think he has any other tricks up his sleeve.
Well, in rallying his base with nativism and xenophobia, but just to try and get some clarity on this, my understanding, and you've dealt with these politicians like presidents at the level of politician to politician, when they meet with other world leaders, isn't there a kind of natural camaraderie amongst political leaders? You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. They help each other as politicians. They always have nice communiques as they finish up summits that are beneficial to both sides. That's just my understanding of the way the game has been played up until now. But this president we have now does the opposite. He actually attacks foreign leaders that have been our longest standing allies and undermines their political security, as he is doing now with Merkel. I mean, she's hanging by a thread, and he's helping the opposition. That's never happened before, from what I can tell.
It's certainly not in my political lifetime. And you're right to say that normally when a president sits down with a counterpart or in a big meeting like the NATO summit, you have an agenda, you work through the agenda. The main goal is to arrive at a consensus and to demonstrate solidarity. Trump's main goal is the opposite. He goes in to break China. He goes in to alienate allies. He doesn't really process information in the same way that his predecessors have, where they work through issues and try to find a solution. And you know, he also, I think, treats people pretty shabbily. There was a report that came out of the summit, the G7 summit in Canada, that he threw some candy at Chancellor Merkel of Germany and said to her, "Hey, Angela, don't tell me that I never give you anything." So we're dealing with a president who has broken the mold, who doesn't sit down and go over the issues in detail, and frankly, who makes decisions at the spur of the moment in a way that even his closest advisors find perplexing. I think, for example, when he met with Kim Jong-un, he canceled U.S. exercises with South Korea on the peninsula, and everybody, the Pentagon, the National Security Advisor, the State Department, they all had whiplash. They said, where did that come from? And so you never know what you're going to get when the president is in a bilateral or a multilateral meeting, because he doesn't go by the briefing book.
Well, I must say, tossing candy at Angela Merkel sounds like Trump tossing paper towels down when he visited Puerto Rico after the devastating hurricane. It's such a humiliating thing to do. That's just breathtaking. I'd never heard that before. Charles Kupchan, I thank you for joining us. I hope it's not going to be as bad as we think, but I take it that the European leaders are extremely nervous about this upcoming NATO summit.
It's going to be a bouncy week. We should all fasten our seatbelts.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who is Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as special assistant to President Obama for national security, and he's the author of Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Martis. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Alejandra Larriva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.